final stage of Jewish mysticism as much as we can reach it in the course of this week. What I'd like to do to start today's class by reviewing very quickly the text that we read yesterday. Since we read it continuously yesterday, I'm going to read it partially today. Anyone need a couple of questions?
I don't
want to
bother.
The text that we are looking at has extreme importance. This is the description of Rav Shlomo Alkaber, of the mystical moment of the life of Joseph Kalb. It has incredible importance because of the following reason. This is the first text, this is the first mystical text in an autobiographical voice that has been printed. It made immense importance on mystical life and mystical circles all along the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. We have numerous, the older you have to say, okay, I repeat, the text that we read is Shlomo Alkaber's epistle or letter describing the Eve of Shavuot of 1533 in Saloniki, Adrianople in Turkey. The moment is celebrating Tikkun Lel Shavuot. The Zohar takes a great importance on the Eve of Shavuot. It's considered to be the mystical moment of unity, the mystical togetherness, the mystical wedding, where Shekhinah and Kudsh HaBrit are united. It's definitely depicted as a wedding, and naturally as a moment of hope and harmony and happiness and celebration, like in a human, like in such resembling human events. However, a human event usually of a wedding is called Brit. It's called Brit Nisuit, covenant of the wedding. What we are celebrating here is the renewal of the covenant, because the Zohar claims, according to the ancient Merkava mysticism, that Chag HaShavuot, the day of the giving of the law, the moment of the vision of the Merkava in Sinai, which later on has been replicated by Ezekiel Merkava, is re-celebrated by the mystical reading of it. So, you're all familiar with the idea of Tikkun Lel Shavuot. Until today we do it, although people don't know usually where it's coming from. It comes from the Zohar. The Zohar is the first source known to us, which contends that Shavuot should be understood as a wedding, as a celebration, as a great renewal of the covenant. And it is depicted as a marriage between a Shekhinah and Knesset Israel. Now, on this celebration moment, Caro and his friends are reading together the Zohar. Caro and his friends are reading together the Zohar, the Mishnah, the 24 books, because, you may ask why, because somewhere in the Gemara, I forgot the exact place, we are told that Kala, a bride, should be adorned with 24 jewels. A bride which is not adorned with 24 jewels is considered to be not properly ready to go into the chuppah. What are those 24 jewels? The mystical exponents say those are the 24 books of the Tanakh. Now, you should read some, or portion of, or allusion, or condensation of the 24 books. So the idea of adornment, which is tikkun, which is lehatkin, which is to prepare, to beautify. The idea of the mystical adornment of the bride is reading in one form or another, or expanding in one form or another, all 24 books during the night of Shavuot. So that's what they're doing. And it goes like this. We're looking on the top page 100. Yes, please. It's also part of it. I mean, there are numerous ways Shlomo Ibn Gavi wrote poetry and the Akdamot. And the idea is that the adornment has to refer to the 24 books. And they in turn are considered to be commemoration of the 24 priestly watchers. The idea of 24 is part of the perception of the mystical beautification of the bride and the bride. So here they are there in a very celebratious moment. They are all very happy, the eve of Shavuot. And we are told that that's what's going on. The person who described it is Shlomo Alphabet, and he writes it in a letter to people who were not present. We studied the whole of the order of Ra'im in the Mishnah, and then we studied in the way of food. Remember this expression, way of food, Derech Emet is the terminus definitus for the Kabbalah. No sooner had we studied two tracts of the Mishnah than our Creator smote us so that we heard a voice speaking out of the mouth of the saint. May his light shine. Of course, the mouth of the saint is Yosef Kav, through the mouth of Kav. It was a loud voice with letters clearly enunciated. All the companions heard the voice but were unable to understand what was said. When before we are told about very loud voice, very striking voice, that is not exactly understandable. Where is that? In Har Sinai. In Parashat, in Shmot Yotzeh, in the description of Mount Sinai. That's what they are reenacting here, reliving here. It's like a sacred theater in a sense, a mystical elevation or a mystical ascent, which the process of is Mahamad Sinai. All the companions heard the voice but were unable to understand what was said. It was an exceedingly pleasant voice, becoming increasingly strong. We all fell upon our faces, and none of us had any spirit left in us, because of our great dread and awe. The voice began to address us, saying, "Friends, choicest of the choice, peace to you, beloved companions. Happy are you, and happy those that bore you. Happy are you in this world, and happy in the next, that you are resolved to adorn me on this night." Notice the idea of adornment. Now, the Hebrew word here is le'ateroti. Le'ater is to beautify and to adorn, but it also has to do with the word atara. Atara is a crown. Atara is the crown, the bridal crown, or the bridal wreath that the bride is wearing in the eve of the Hatuna, of the wedding. Happy are you, and happy those that bore you. Happy are you in this world, and happy in the next that you are resolved to adorn me on this night. So notice we start with a great deal of happiness, as in a way. For these many years, now from here there is a very strong turn. Now we are not celebrating anymore, and I want you to tell me on which voice this is now speaking. For these many years, had my head been fallen with none to comfort me. I was cast down on the ground to embrace the dungeon. Where is that from? Echa, that's Megillat Echa. The daughter of Dan, in the voice of Megillat Echa, is describing herself as Choveket Ashpatot, embracing the dungeon, as a metaphor of the world, the one who has been a princess and crowned beauty, has been fallen. That's of course the metaphor of the destruction of the temple, of the devastation of Jerusalem, of the destruction of the Jewish community in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, in the destruction of the first temple. The daughter of Zion in Lamentations is, as you all know from Tisha B'Av reading, it is a description of the tragedy of the destruction. Why destruction in the middle of the wedding? Why in the midst of this great happiness all of a sudden we have this sad voice? So she said, "I was cast down to the ground to embrace the dungeon, but now you have restored the crown to its former place." Remember, the bride is crowned, the bride is adored. Now you, the students who are studying the 24 beautifications or the 24 biblical portions or the 24 things from the Mishnah, well, they are the active participants in the adornment. The adornment here is also elevation, it's also redemption. "I was cast down to the ground to embrace the dungeon, but now you have restored the crown to its former place. Be strong, my beloved ones. Be courageous, my friends. Rejoice and exult, for you belong among the chosen few. You have the merit of belonging to the king's palace. The sound of your Torah and the breath of your mouth have ascended to the Holy One, blessed be He, breaking through many firmaments and many atmospheres until it rose upward. Now notice the following sentence. The angels were silent, the seraphim still, Hayot stood without speech, and all the host of heaven heard, together with the Holy One, blessed be He, the sound of your voice. Wherefrom is this verse? Also from Ma'amad Sinai. The complete stillness, the complete freezing of heaven and earth in the moment of the divine revelation in Sinai is reenacted here. Now it is those who are participating. Remember, this is the eve of Shavuot. This is the moment of the covenant. They are renewing the covenant by the reading. They are getting a divine affirmation of the reading through the mouth of God. The angels were silent, the seraphim still, Hayot stood without speech, and all the hosts of heaven heard together with the Holy One, blessed be He, the sound of your voice. Behold, I am the Mishnah. Now, the Kala is turned to be the Mishnah, the Shekhinah. It's the same feminine entity, identified as Kala, Mishnah, Atara, Shekhinah. It's all the same. Only here, this entity, which is well introduced in the Zohar, which is beautifully introduced in the Vahir, now this entity turns to be a speaking voice. I want you to pay attention for that, because this is exactly the mystical moment, or the passage from Midrash to mysticism, from a story to a moment of sacred ritual, which is a life. For them, the texts that are well familiar by every reader, those are no new texts, those are the texts of the Zohar, the texts of the Midrash, the texts of Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabirol, all what we usually read in the Eve of Shavuot. Now all of this is amalgamated into one speaking voice through the mouth of Karo. Karo's voice is turned to be from male into a female voice. The Shekhinah is speaking. In Hebrew, as you know, every verb must be either male or female. You can easily distinguish between a male voice or a female voice, even if you don't hear it, by the conjugation and verb form. Until here, the Shekhinah is saying, Ani ha-Mishnah medaberet elecha, Ani ha-Shekhinah medaberet. The voice introduces itself in a female form. I am the Mishnah, the mother who chastised her children, and I have come to converse with you. Had you been 10 in number, you would have ascended even higher, but you have reached a great higher nevertheless. Happy are those who bore you, my friend, in that by denying yourself sleep, you have ascended so far on high. The idea that one should not sleep in the eve of Shavuot is from the Zohar. The Zohar says that this is the night when heaven is open, when the unification between the bride and the bridegroom is taking place, and nobody should be asleep in this night, because this is the height of the mystical year. So she is blessing them and says, my friend, in death by denying yourself sleep, you have ascended so far on high. Through you I have become elevated. This is what's so important. Through you the readers, through you the participants, through you Chavurat Kedosha, holy group, through you I, the Shekhinah, have been elevated. Through you I have become elevated this night, and through the companions in the great city, a mother city in Israel, that another group who is engaged in the same thing. You are not like those who sleep on beds of ivory, in sleep which is the 60th of death. This is of course a reference to the prophetic description of people of, who are sleeping on beds of ivory, who stretch themselves out upon their couches. But you cleave to your Creator, and He rejoices in you. Now the verb that mysticism is using time and again is cleaving. You cleave. Let the bed, the foot. I want you to remember that in Hebrew, the verb cleaving, the foot, has a very strong erotic connotation. It comes from the verb which describes Adam v'Chava, al ken yazov ish et aviv v'imo, v'davak v'ishto v'hayu levasar echad. The unification has the very clear human metaphor of togetherness, of unification, of mating. The very same thing is described in the heavenly union or in the human heavenly moment of ascension. But you cleave to your Creator, and He rejoices in you. Therefore, my son, be strong and rejoice in my love, rejoice in my Torah, rejoice in the fear of me. Now, of course, this voice is two kinds. When the voice says Torati, Mishnati, the Hebrew origin is my son, be strong and rejoice. Hizku ve'imtsu. In my love, Hizku ve'imtsu be'ahavati, rejoice in my Torah, be'torati, rejoice in the fear of me. Be'ir'ati, be'ahavati, be'torati, be'ir'ati. Those concepts, of course, refer to the relations between man and his Creator. Love and fear are the expectations of human behavior towards the Creator. Only here the Creator is extended to the Mishnah, Shekhinah, Neshama, direct mode. It is like an announcement of direct divine revelation, of divine entity, which has the mystical elevation, potency, the mystical Shekhinah, and the classical perception of the God Creator in the moment of revelation, in fact. If you could only imagine 1 millionth of the anguish which I endured, no joy would ever enter your heart, and no mirth your mouth. Now the divine voice here is desolated one, is troubled one, is terrified one. As I said, the divinity here is incarnated in the voice of Megillat Eicha, of the daughter of Zion from Lamentation. The worst and the most sad and desolated entity. Only what is the innovation there? In Eicha, in Lamentation, it's the community of Israel which is speaking. It is not the Mishnah, it is not the Shekhinah, it is not the deity. It is the community of Israel, Bat Zion, the daughter of Zion. Here, the daughter of Zion is projected on the deity. Now the Shekhinah is Bat Zion. Now the Shekhinah is the community of Israel. Now the Shekhinah is the Atara, the community of Israel, the divine entity, which is feminized and which is becoming to be utterly dependent on human help. I repeat the last sentence. If you could only imagine 1 millionth of the anguish which I endured, no joy would ever enter your heart, and no mirth your mouth. For it is because of you that I am cast to the ground. Therefore, O my dear son, be strong and of good courage and rejoice. Cease not from studying, for a thread of mercy stretched out over you, and your Torah study is pleasant to the Holy One. Now here we have the practical conclusions of this divine revelation. Until here we had a moment of divine speech. From here now we have demands and instructions. So the voice instructs, O my dear son, be strong in good courage and rejoice. Cease not from studying. Now those people are studying. We have no doubt about it. The circle of Yosef Karo, the author of Bet Yosef, Magid Meisharim, Magid Mishneh, Kesef Mishneh, Shulchan Aruch, Avkat Rochel, and more, he was definitely an ardent student. To tell to Karo to study is like to tell to Einstein, do some mathematics. Okay? You don't need to art study the person that all his life are embedded in study. The same is very true to Shlomo Alchabet, who is a notable author of many books. The same is true for Moshe Cordovero, the notable author of many books. The other people who are present there, they are all among Talmidei Chachamim. They are all people who are studying ceaselessly, as it is anyhow. However, now this voice is telling them that by the very course of study, they are participating in redeeming the Shekhinah, in the elevation of the Shekhinah. O my dear sons, be strong and of good courage and rejoice. Cease not from studying, for a thread of mercy is stretched out over you, and your Torah study is pleasant to the Holy One, blessed be He. Therefore stand upon your feet and raise me up. When you stand, you raise me. Saying in a loud voice, as on the Day of Atonement, blessed be the name of His glorious kingdom forever and ever. We then rose to our feet with the joints of our loins loosened. This is a reference to Daniel. Kitrei charaseinu nishtarim. This is something in Aramaic which means that, as it's translated here, that the joints of our loins loosened, like entirely with awe and frightfulness. And we proclaimed in a loud voice, blessed be the name of His glorious kingdom forever and ever. He then repeated, happy are you, return to your studies, not interrupting them for one moment. Notice the whole encompassing demand of study. Study, study, study. Go up to the land of Israel. Now this is the second announcement, the second instruction. First of all, comprehensive study. Second, go up to the land of Israel. For not all times are opportune. There is no hindrance to salvation, be it much or little. Let not your eyes have pity on your worldly goods, for your ease of the goodness of the high land, of the higher land. If you will but hear them, of the goodness of that land will you. Make haste, therefore, to go up to the land, for I sustain you here and will sustain you there. To you will be peace, to your household peace, and to all that is with you. The Lord gives strength to His people, the Lord will bless His people with peace. Now the priestly notion behind this seemingly priestly blessing is very striking. But we should remember that the whole revelation of the Sinai revelation, the moment of divine speech, the reenactment of the Eve of Shavuot, all of that together, is putting together all kinds of traditions. You remember that, according to the portions that we have read in the previous part of the class, Ma'amad Sinai and Chazon HaMerkava are associated and combined. According to the mystical tradition and according to the Midrashic tradition, like in Sikta Rabati and Sikta Deras Kahana, in the moment of the final revelation, there was a chariot revelation. A divine voice and the divine chariot and the divine presence and the divine angels are all considered to be part of the theophany, part of the divine revelation in the eve of Shavuot, in the holy day of Shavuot. The word Shavuot is from Shavuot, it's from covenant. We think usually that Shavuot is derived from Shiva Shavuot, which is true as well. However, it's not only from 7 weeks, it's also from the word Shavuot, covenant. Oh, resuming of the covenant is what the holy day of Shavuot is about. However, since this resuming of the covenant was the major interest of the priestly perception, it has been considerably marginalized by the sages' tradition. The sages didn't make Shavuot into a notable holiday. As you know, there is no Mishnah for Chag HaShavuot. Unlike the other Chagim, which are mentioned in Parashat HaMoadot deVayikra, which are well addressed in the Mishnah, and which are accompanied with considerable detail and exposition, Shavuot has no Mishnah. This holiday has no Mishnah and has no Gemara. What? You doubt that it's right? There is no Mishnah on Chag HaShavuot. Hanukkah is not to be compared. Hanukkah is not one of Moadei Adonai. I'm talking on the holidays which are Moadei Adonai, Asher Tikra'u Ota B'Moada, in Vayikra, Vayikra Shachine. Hanukkah is not at all to be compared. Hanukkah, at the most, is a holiday which is celebrating a miraculous success, a moment, according to the Hashmonaim. It hasn't been accepted by the entire community of Israel until rather late, and it certainly never had a moment of appointed time of the Lord as the other holiday in Vayikra. However, there are two... There has been, but it has been marginalized and suppressed. There has been quite a lot. So we are told by Tzeret HaYachad, so we are told by the Book of Jubilee. There was quite a lot. The idea of Chag HaShavuot was the reproving of the covenant, was re-celebrating annually the covenant of Sinai. But since there was a great deal of tension between sages and priests about the nature of the covenant, about the time of the covenant, as you know, Shavuot doesn't have a date in the Bible. The Bible does not tell us what is the date that Shavuot should be celebrated. Bible scholars, who have nothing to do with mystical writings, claim that it should have been in the middle of the third month, the 15th of the third month, according to the priestly mystical tradition from Qumran, Jubilee, and others. However, now our point is not the ancient tradition, but the point that the mystical covenant has been resumed in the eve of Shavuot by the Zohar. The Zohar is containing all kinds of residue of priestly tradition. It's hard to say whether they continue directly from Jubilee, whether they take it from Enoch, whether they take it from Megillat HaMikdash, whether they have other priestly sources that are not available to us. One thing is for sure, the Zohar considers Shavuot to be the most important, together with Yom Kippur. The two most important holy days are Shavuot and Yom Kippur. Both of them are the background for mystical elevation, for mystical resuming of the divine voice. It's not in vain that Karo's inaugural moment is in the eve of Shavuot. It is not in vain at all that Moshe Lutzato, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, Rambam, in Padua, in the first third of the 18th century, is having a very similar experience in the eve of Shavuot. It's not in vain that Shabtai Tzvi inaugurates in his mystical moment, which started with the best of intentions. Only later on everything was ruined. But when he started as a mystical Messiah, he started in the eve of Shavuot. All of them are imitating Karo. All of them are imitating the Zohar description of the eve of Shavuot. If you would look in the compilations of the Zohar in English or in Hebrew or in Aramaic, and you would look on the indices under Tikkun Leil Shavuot or Leil Shavuot or Ichuda Shel Kala V'Chata, you would see the great textual background of that beautiful moment. The moment that the divine voice once upon a time had been revealing itself publicly, and according to the mystical moment, it may reveal itself again to the chosen few. It might. Doesn't have to, but it might. It is a fact that we have numerous occasions where the eve of Shavuot is the beginning of a great mystical new movement or new message or prophetic message. That's the way it was in the days of old, as far as Moses and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai are concerned, according to the literary evidence, and as the new readers are expounding it and reenacting it and reliving it. Now that's the point that I want to be very clear. Texts are numerous, midrashim are numerous, but the moment between the score to the music, between the myth to the mysticism, is exactly this. When you read the old text and when you interiorize them and you are redoing them, you are reliving them. Now, of course, not everyone could be a candidate that the voice of Moses or the voice of God would speak for his throne. However, there were about four or five people of that caliber or of that level that their surrounding group accepted it. Now, I want you to understand here the very important notion of charismatic leadership. You're all familiar with the word charisma. I don't know how many of you realize that the word charisma is coming from Greek, which means divine blessing or divine spirit is enhanced on you. Now what is enthusiasm? Theos has been possessing them. The word enthusiasm that we use daily, not realizing the origin of it, has the word theos in it. Enthusiastic is a person who is possessed by a divine spirit. Now, many of us may claim that we are possessed by divine spirit, but it needs the other side. That's the other side of charisma. That somebody else would acknowledge our truth. When this person who is alleged possessed with divine spirit He needs the acceptance or the acknowledgement of the holy group of answers. The idea of Chabura Kadisha, which later is known as Chevre Kadisha, now we are familiar with Chevre Kadisha in the context of Metin, of death, but that of course was not the origin of it. Chevre Kadisha means holy group, which is accepting upon itself far stricter demands in order to create a holy space where divine revelation might occur. That's the idea of Chesbat Kedusha, of holy book. Those holy books start in Hechalot literature around Rabbi Akiva. Those holy books continue in the Gaonic period according to the testimonies of the Geonim, of people who are reading Hechalot literature. Those holy books are continuing in Hasidei Ashkenaz, who accept upon themselves very strict measures of piety and devotion in order to create a holy space where divine revelation may occur. This divine revelation could be addressed as Gilui Eliyahu, Elijah the Pharisee. It could be addressed as Bakol, a voice, a divine voice. It could be addressed as Gilui like Theophany or Epiphany. However, those things don't just happen. They have to be prepared for. They have to be intended to. They have to be part of a conceptual world which leaves room for them. Now, of course, people can say, look, according to rational measures, that's impossible. But first of all, people are not only rational. Second of all, the whole history of religion is full with people who were able to be engaged in some kind of a divine revelation and to impart such message to the others that affirm their prophetic, religious, inspired moment. We have to consider the following. That has happened and could have happened in every century. The fact that the sages say that prophecy is still is a very problematic contention because it is not corroborated by history, nor is it corroborated by human experience, nor by history of religion. In the very same time that the sages argue that prophecy has been sealed, they said that it was the 5th century B.C. when the last prophecy would be given.
There's a testimony in Matthew. The book of Matthew has testimony that we looked to the books because there has been a long time since there was any word of prophet. That there is such a testimony among, and not the only testimony, but there certainly is such a testimony in 2nd century BCE writing that it has been a while since prophecy has ceased.
That's correct. However, my point is that while there is no doubt that certain books claim that prophecy has ceased, other books deny this claim entirely. Now, the fact that one book, important as might be, would contend that there is no more prophecy does not mean that all other groups would accept this contention. The interesting fact is that while Rabbi Akiva, among the sages, is among those who are associated with the ceasing of prophecy claim, at the very same time, this Rabbi Akiva is described in Hechalot literature as a prophet, as a person who is ascending to heaven, who is coming down with a new message, with a new poetical, mystical message of divine law. Now, it's true that he's not coming down with law, he's coming down with poetry. Hechalot literature, according to the self-perception of its authors and redactors, is the divine message brought down from heaven to earth by Rabbi Akiva. Isn't that interesting? That the very same person who in the Mishnaic corpus is associated with injunctions such as do not read books which are not canonized, do not read books which I don't consider inspired, there is no more prophecy anymore, the very same person is associated with mystical ascension within the Mishnah itself. The story of Paul entered the orchard is a story of a mystical experience of whatever kind. The Hechalot literature claims that they are the elaboration of the mystical experience of Rabbi Akiva. Now Rabbi Akiva claims that prophecy has been seized for everyone else, but not for himself. Chagiga and Vati Chagiga and Yerushalmi Chagiga and Tosefta is associated with Agadah, with mysticism, with mystical ascent, with Pardes. This is very obvious. Only the point is that he does not acknowledge accessibility of such things to other people. For everybody else, he says there is no more prophecy, but for me, there is prophecy. Yes.
Maybe we should distinguish between what's called apostolic prophecy and other prophecy.
Well, there are probably numerous kinds of prophecies. However, let's say that the idea of prophecy is being inspired by divine revelation, translated into human words. Now, the content of this translation could be Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, or could be poetical notions, or could be Karo's notions, or could be Ramchal or Baal Shem. So my point is that the fact that there is a certain paradigm in Jewish history that prophecy had ceased in the 5th century BC has not been unanimously adopted by all other circles. In fact, the whole body of mystical literature attests to the contrary. When Rabbi Abraham ben David in 12th century Corban, when Itzhak Saginao, his son, in the end of the century, beginning of the 13th century, the end of the 12th, the course of the 13th century, when Abraham Abulafia in the 13th century, when the author of the Zohar in the 13th century, when Karo in the 16th century, and numerous others, Luria in the 16th century, Shabbatai Tzvi in the 17th century, Schlein in the 17th century, Baal Shem Tov and Dagra in the 18th century, when all of those people claim that they had a divine revelation, they are bringing a message from heaven in one way or another, they are engaged in prophetic authority with charismatic claim. Remember, the word charisma, referring to charismatic leadership, to charismatic message, is nothing but a person who is speaking under divine inspiration, with heavenly authority embedded in. Now, of course, you need the other side of it, which is acceptance of the people around you to the veracity of your claim, to the new content of your claim, to the new message of your claim, to the probability of your claim. Now, if you are such a person as Yosef Karo, nobody would doubt you. You are already the highest authority of the generation. Now, of course, I know that this contention is complex and it raises many questions, and everyone would have now a chance to remark. However, do remember that there is not one-sided course of historical response to the elimination of prophecy. Now, we should ask ourselves before anything else, why are we told that prophecy has been ceased? What is the reason for ceasing of prophecy? Is it really true that it has ceased? Are people such as Jesus from Nazareth, or John the Baptist, or Moreh Tzedek of Qumran, are representation of prophetic message? In their eyes, they are certainly so. They did not enjoy the acceptance of the whole entire community, but that was also the case with the biblical prophets. Not all of them were accepted by the whole entire community. Okay, I'll stop here and let Ellen, you wanted to remark yet?
You say you cannot read more books, you use the word para. I would have the impression that para meant to read as can. The rabbi cited the same theorem. You say you're not allowed to be correct, which means to read as can. The book is by now some wisdom tradition. It is not canonical. Second, it would seem to me there's a difference between apocalypse and prophecy. One may allow that from a prophecy guy. Apocalypse perhaps with the lover, but in the next lower form,
we should be very, very careful with using words which are not Hebrew. In that case, the word apocalypse is nothing but chazon. If you say chazon and you say nevuah, you know very quickly that chazon and nevuah are the same. Chazon asher chazay Yirmiyahu, chazon asher chazay Yehezkel is exactly the definition of prophecy. When you use the Greek word apocalypse, you can say I can distinguish between apocalyptic and prophecy. This is not the case in Hebrew. In Hebrew there is no distinction between chazon and nevuah. Now, just one second. I do not disagree that there might be different degrees of prophecy. Certainly, the sages also say that there were thousands of prophets, but no to get into that. All of those are very important and interesting questions, but none of them denies the fact that we have numerous textual testimonies of ongoing prophetic or visionary writing. You're quite right. The only one that may claim to have legal revelation is the Hayosef Kaba. However, let's say that we want to keep in mind that on one side there are severe restrictions on an ongoing inspired writing. On the other side, there is ongoing inspired writing. The fact that there is a prohibition does not mean that it has been stopped. Okay? All I want is this tension. Recognizing the tension there, there is restriction, limitation, censorship, inhibition on one side, and there is an ongoing output inspired by divine revelation, divine prophecy, angelic messengers, bat kol, Elijah apparition. You can call it as you wish, as long as we know that there are people amongst us who continue to write and to preach and to expound under the claim of divine revelation. Yes, Leah, you want to do wrong? I can't hear you, I'm very sorry. One more time and clear.
In the Gemara, so many times in the Gemara, you know, the Gemara will say that Eliyahu will hear today.
Yeah, but when they say, do they make halakhic injunctions under Eliyahu? They don't. They are, Eliyahu is part of the Agadah, is not part of the halakha, right? In some cases, in Jewish mysticism, Eliyahu would be part of the halakhic exposition, not only part of the agadic exposition.
But sometimes they'll say that Eliyahu is part of halakha.
Well, as I said, but it is not taken as a source or as a point in argument. The local classical of the question whether there is room for divine intervention in halakhic judicial injunctions is, of course, Tanuro shel Achnai, the Baba Messiah 59a source, that tells us very clearly that within halakhic dialogue there is no room for direct divine revelation or intervention or prophetic charismatic legitimation of any kind. That has been well established. The point is that beyond the discourse, beyond the halakhic discourse, there are other avenues of creativity which are addressed and written and expounded and adopted no less than the halakhic course. Yes. You must talk loud.
A completely different question. I'm just curious, what's happening in the world of Kabbalah and mysticism? I mean, over 200 years between the writing of the Zohar and Rishon LeMahalach.
Well, it has been adopted immediately. The Zohar has been adopted immediately as an ancient midrash, and it was understood to be an inspired divine revelation, textual testimony, which deems continuous study, expounding, elaboration, and imitation. The Zohar set itself as exemplary canon, that is, a topos of writing that should be imitated, unlike the Mishnah, for instance. Nobody imitating the Mishnah, but the Zohar introduced itself within its own textual frame as a paradigm to be imitated. David ben Yehuda Hasid, writing the 14th century, after the Zohar has been found in the end of the 13th century, right in the beginning of the 14th century, David ben Yehuda Hasid immediately continued to write Maraot HaTzovaot as a continuation of the Zohar. Yosef Angelet is writing Livnat HaSapir as a continuation of the Zohar. Raya Mehena is written in the 14th century as a continuation of the Zohar. The 14th century is rich with continuing writing of the kind of the Zohar. All of them, or most of them, are pseudo-epigraphic. Some of them were put together into the Zohar, and when the Zohar has been printed, there is a portion which is called Zohar Hadash. The publishers in Turkey in the 16th century, when they published the Zohar, they realized that it is not the Zohar of the main body, but there is an additional Zohar or appendices to the Zohar written in the 14th century. In the course of the 14th century, a great deal of enthusiastic writing has been going on, continuing this Zohar. So the Zohar was not closed in a sense, but was growing and growing. In the 15th century, we have less information of what was going on, because a great deal of what was going on was blackened by the expulsion from Spain. The Inquisition and the persecutions and the tragedies took over a great deal of the knowledge that might have been from the 15th century of what was going on. However, when we come to the 16th century, we know that people are looking for Zohar, complaining that there is not enough volumes because they were lost in the expulsion, ordering many copies and working towards publication. Now the Zohar says, and I mentioned this already, but I would like to restate it again. The Zohar was very carefully crafted in order to pave avenues to the future. It realized that by inventing the past, it could invent the future. But the loop was the following. The Zohar realized something of the following kind. When the sages claimed that they are halakha l'moshe m'sinai, they invent the past. Because the difference, the chronology in time between Moses and the sages is no less than the difference in time between Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Baal HaZohar. There is a millennial difference between Moshe m'sinai and between the sages, presumably more like millennia and a half, between Ma'amad Sinai, Moses, divine revelation, and the sages in the turn of the millennium of the common era, they also invent the past. When they claim that all what they do, halakha l'moshe m'sinai, is making a huge bridge from first century of the common era, or first century BC, back in time, 1200 or 300 years. When they say that it was all given for Moshe in Sinai, of course this is not a clear bibliographical veracity that you can support, because you don't have any middle chains between Moses and Hillel, say. We don't have one continuous body of textual knowledge from Moses to what we call Torah Shebe'al Peh. However, the sages invent the past and they say, all what we do is halakha l'moshe m'sinai, according to the very same rationale, according to the very same logic. The author of the Zohar is reinventing the past by claiming all what I do is the world of the sages. I am Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. My friends are the Tanaim, the sages. All of us together are reliving the past just as much as the sages relive halakha l'moshe m'sinai. Culture is by reinventing the past in order to reinvent the future. Why did the sages need to invent halakha l'moshe m'sinai? Because they wanted legitimacy that was contested severely by others. When the priests were the source of legitimacy for thousands of years, and they are completely eradicated from Shalshelet HaMasorah in Pirkei Avot, we should ask, what had happened to the priesthood in Moshe Kibel Torah Mitzvot Sinai, Mitzara LeYoshua, Yoshua LeNeviim, Neviim LeChachamim, Neviim Etkenim, Kenim LeChachamim, Anshei Knesset Gdolah? What is this? Who has been deleted? The priests who were the writers, transmitters, teachers, keepers of the divine word have been omitted out, have been censored out. In order to do a bridge from the time of the sages directly back to Moses without the priesthood, they invented the idea of halakha l'moshe. And I see certainly no bibliographical truth here, but there is a cultural truth here. There is a very profound understanding that all they are doing, expounding the sacred text, is within the spirit of halakha l'moshe m'sinai, even if it hasn't been given by Moshe. Like they say that everything that Talmid Chacham Atid L'chadesh already has been taught by Moses. Now of course this is not the case, but this is the source of legitimacy and veracity, marginalizes other sources of legitimacy. When the sages say that they the ladder of the priesthood. We have another path, another avenue. When the mystics in the 13th century reinvent the sages' world, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, Rabbi Eliezer ben Shimon, and so on and so forth, all these different people of the Zohar, they are doing a bridge over 1,000 years difference between the 13th century to the 2nd century, and they say, we are reliving Moshe, we are reliving Shimon ben Yochai, and we would tell you all what they have been doing if they would have been asked, if they could have been writing down. They are continuing to lead them, they are reenacting them, they are rewriting them, they are lending them a voice. And what else do they do? They say the following. The Zohar has this ingenious idea. The Zohar says, Elijah said to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, how righteous you are, and how great is your portion in this world and in the world to come, that by the book that you authored, you, Shimon bar Yochai, under my inspiration, Elijah, the Jewish people will be coming out of exile towards redemption. And the continuation of this verse is, only when they would study the Zohar and expound it and write more like it, only then redemption will come. I call it the double loop of legitimizing the veracity of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and assuring that by the very revelation of the text, which has been sealed for 1,000 years, because if it has been written in 2nd century and revealed in 13th century, 1,000 years is missing where that book has been. The answer is, it was intended to be ganum. It was intended to be sealed, to be hidden, until time of redemption would start. The very revelation of the text of the Zohar is the best sign that redemption is coming. It would hasten and would come back only when you would read it thoroughly. That means when you would read the Bible looking for the hidden meaning of it, which is bridging between past and future. They managed to do a wonderful job of it. People were convinced. People were interested. Now, there were always Harishim. There were always people with great philological talent. There were people with grammatical insight who realized that it couldn't have been written by 13th century, by 2nd century writers. Don't think that it was Sholem or Brecht the first who noticed it. Yaakov Emden in the 18th century wrote Mitpachat Tfarim in order to demonstrate that the Zohar hasn't been written by Shimon bar Yochai. Before him, Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh from Modena, the author of Shaddat Aryeh, wrote the whole literature to demonstrate that it's entirely improbable that the Zohar has been written by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Very good grammatical analysis. Numerous other scholars, all written down by Tishbi in the introduction to his monumental book, The Wisdom of the Zohar, which starts by a good introduction of all the history of scholarship on the Zohar from times of old until the 20th century. Many people realize that this is a brilliant literary creativity, not a true historical 2nd century writing, but that didn't make any difference. People realize that it is a pseudo-epigraphic claim. However, the inner power in it, the inspiring source of it, has been celebrated to a great degree. Now, how it has been celebrated? People were studying it, playing with it. Shashua is the word. They were mishtasheim. They were playing with it, exploring it, studying it, connecting every bit and piece of what they have been doing. Every prayer, every mitzvah, every Talmud Torah, every expounding, every exploration, every drasha. They were exploring in the Zohar four-layer presentation of Pardes, Pshat, Remez, Drash, Vetzod. Every word that they are doing. The Zohar says the world is invested with mystery. Let's explore the mysterious meaning of every word of the text. Let's look into them and try to find what is the connection between the hidden world, Olam HaSfirot, and the further hidden world, the Ein Sof, the infinite Ein, and the world of us down here, connected through 613 commandments, 600 certain limbs of the human body and 600 certain portions of the heavenly chariot. Now, I mentioned all this, but what I want to emphasize that very soon after they had been studying this, they were starting to ritualize it. A whole world of rituals has been put forward by the readers of the Zohar. They were not only reading it, they were not only studying, not only expounding, they were living it, they were ritualizing it, they were forming particular spaces, a particular social avenue, a particular social framework to reenact the world of the Zohar. Let it be very clear that Hasidism, Sabbatianism, 16th century mysticism is all one long sequence of expounding the Zohar. The different social strata, of course, are affected by the respective geographical and social and historical conditions, but the one thing that they're all sharing is they are forming holy chavurot, chavura kadisha, chavre kadisha, chavura kadisha. They are forming particular groups who are designating themselves as students of the mystical teaching. They are playing it with role play games, like you would be Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, I would be Rabbi Yehuda Ben Baba, you would be Rabbi Nona, you would be Rabbi Zuka, and so on. Like each one is responsible on a certain person in the Zohar. They are playing, they are studying, they are trying to make more Zohar, more expositions of expounding the mystery, knowing that every moment that they study or they play in that particular vein of expounding the mysterious notion of the text, every moment of such exposition is engagement in elevation of the Shechina. They're not only doing it for their own intellectual curiosity, for their own emotional satisfaction. They are engaged in theurgic mission. They are engaged in redeeming the fallen spark, the desolated Shechina. They are unifying the broken world. They are restoring the broken harmony. They feel very convincingly. When you read a couple of pages of the Zohar, you get into this world. You are part and parcel of the upper world. The Zohar wrote 2,400 pages of the hidden world. As introduced by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and friends who are expounding the biblical text. So we have a group, a narrative, a plot, a text which is of course the sacred text of the Torah, Mishnah, Talmud, Midrash, and rereading it and rewriting it and re-expounding it according to the suggestion that every sentence of the Zohar is connected to the upper one, to the upper spirit, to the world of the divine prophecy. And this world has all kinds of prophecies in it. When you are studying, you are engaging in the divine prophecy, in the unification and separation, in the elevation, in the restoration. All those words are inventions of the Zohar for whatever people are doing. So you're not only reading Shavuot, you're not only reading Zohar al Shavuot, you are reenacting the story of the Zohar al Shavuot in your own group. What Karo starts is by doing Tikkun Leil Shavuot. The Zohar instructs us that Leil Shavuot is the appropriate time for adorning and beautifying the bride, which is on its way to be united in the day of Shavuot with her groom. And what we need to do is to study. They are studying in the middle of this study process, in the middle of this poetical, mystical, hermeneutical engagement. Some of them are elevated more than others. One of them is getting into a trance, reincarnating in himself the voice of the Shechina. Those things happen, but the point that I want to say is that you need a place and the holy time and the holy place and the text to those things happen. The Kubalim, Kabbalists, mystics, Trushim v'chassidim, ascetics and devotionals were engaging together in study process of the Zohar. Mystical Judaism was springing all over Europe, all over the Middle East, all over the land of Israel, if one would write down the number of Chaburot Hasidiyot, Chaburot Mekubalim, Chaburot Mekubalim Hasidim Ugrushim, they are endless, they are numerous. 400 books of Kabbalah were published between 16th century and 19th century. That's a lot. 400 different books. Not to speak on 4,000 manuscripts, thousands of manuscripts, hundreds of volumes, which many people were engaged in writing, publishing, editing, studying, demanding, forming a market. All of that is taking place after printing become available. When printing become available, you didn't need to be a very rich person to acquire a manuscript. To be an owner of a manuscript, you could be either your own, a very proficient writer and copier, or to pay to somebody else. To copy a book is quite a thing. To print a book immediately enlarged the community of students to a great deal, because printed books were available in Batei HaMidrash, in the library, to every member of the community. Some members who said, let's make a chabura, let's form a bunch, a group, a bond of people who are committing themselves to an ongoing study. We have wonderful descriptions of Chaburat Ramchal, the 18th century Italian group, which is a continuation of the Chabura that he himself was part of as a student with Benjamin Bassan, which is a continuation of the Chabura that Abraham Zakut, his teacher, was teaching previously. So all along the 17th, 18th century Italy, numerous chaburot are trending. Within those chaburot, mystical writings are being copied. Books are being ordered, commissioned, published, disseminated. This is a world which is growing. At the very same time, in Turkey, they're involved in the very same thing. Most Kabbalistic books have been published either in Venice or in Turkey in the beginning. However, you may realize that by that time, there were other circles who would say, this is dangerous, this is subversive, this might endanger the unity of the community. Why is that the way? We always wanted people to study. Certainly nobody who studies Zohar does anything against halakha. They are very devotional, they are very pious, they are very much engaged in expounding the faith. Only one reason, because they feel that you need to be very devotional, very pious, very ascetic, they enact standards which are higher than the rest of the community. Let's say all the community is eating, of course, from Shchita Sheva. But the members of those Chaburot would say, we want a higher degree of Shchita Sheva, not like everybody else, a higher degree. The whole community is praying according, let's say, Minhag Ashkenaz. The Chaburot say, we want to pray according to the Loyanic Sephardic thing. Now very soon, some people would say, how dare you? How dare you neglect our sacred custom based on our holy fathers from Ashkenaz, the Mekadshei Hashem from the times of the Crusaders, who are the founders of Minhag Ashkenaz, Ashkenaz of course is Germany, our holy fathers from the Rhineland, who are the founders of Minhag Ashkenaz. How can you in the 16th, 17th, 18th century dare to change those minhagim? They would say, we would like to wear two sets of tefillin, two sets of philosophy. Because somewhere it is said that tefillin de Rabbeinu Tam, tefillin de Rashi, they are for the exclusive people. Let's say that if in Shulchan Aruch we are told that only people who are Yechidei Tevula should wear two pairs of tefillin, the people who are involved in studying the mystical text say, we are those Yechidei Tevula, we are those extraordinary gifted people who should demand from themselves much higher demands and should allow themselves higher degrees of purity, asceticism, excellence in guarding all the details of the minhagim and so on and so forth. Soon enough, social tension would grow and people would say, our meat is not good enough for you to eat. What do you mean by that? We are insulted. If you are eating only from your shchita, it means that you are not paying the taxes for our shchita. If you are eating only on your way of arranging separated communes. That's where tension starts. It's not at all a tension on content. There is no argument about the sacredness of the Zohar, about the depth of the Zohar, about the beauty and inspiring capacity in it. There is a very strong fight concerning the right of individuals to depart from the communal tradition for the sake of being more pious than others, more devotional than others, more tzaddikim than others. This is really the inner meaning of what's later on known as Hasidim and Mitnagdim, but was previously Hasidim and Mitnagdim, the devotional, the pious on the one side, and the Mitnagdim and opponents on the other side. All the difference between them, and I say time and again, there is no social difference between them. There is no difference in capacity, in education, in background, none whatsoever. They are coming from the very same circle, the circles of the Lomdin. However, there is one fundamental difference. The Mitnagdim, or the opponents of the different periods, would be those who would say, we, the foundation of the community, are guarding the traditional minhag Ashkenaz, traditional minhag Romaniyot, traditional minhag Turkey. We are the guardians of the tradition. You are breaking the tradition on account of piety, not on account of antinomism, on account of extra piety. If we all pray according to minhag Ashkenaz and you pray according to minhag Sfarad, you are breaking the unity of the community. You are endangering the tradition, the continuity, the identity. That happened century after century. Before Hasidim and Mitnagdim, people mistakenly think that it happens only with Hasidim and Mitnagdim. No, this is not the case. Always there was a tension between the spiritual excellence demonstrated by the Kabbalistic community and the traditional general community who say, we are the guardians of tradition. We are the guardians of the way things ought to be. And we don't think that everybody has to engage in Kabbalistic practice. The Kabbalists say, yes, everybody should, and the better, and the more the better, and there are degrees, however, it should not be eliminated. Yes. No, on Hasidei Ashkenaz, we don't know such a tension, but this is 12th century, this is before Kabbalah. Hasidei Ashkenaz are not Kabbalah.
So Shama says that, and Shama was said that by having your own sense of piety, they're basically rejecting the validity of Kabbalah.
Well, how...
They didn't raise that opposition.
Well, we don't have historical evidence to such a tension. It doesn't mean that there hasn't been. It might be that the communities were so very small, that's the historical record that apparently, that they could have either recruit the whole community to their way or do it secretly enough that it would not affect others. However, I'm not talking of Hasidei Ashkenaz because we don't have enough material about it. But we do have enough material about tension in 16th century Italy and 16th century Turkey and 17th century Eretz Israel. We have plenty of tensions between the groups which are engaged in more pious ways of life in order to engage in the study of Kabbalah, in order to redeem the Shekhinah and bringing forward the Messianic redemption, and for those purposes, they are accepting on themselves much more rigorous pietistic measures. At the very same time, those extra rigorous pietistic measures are raising criticism from various courts, from various sides. Yes. They are with halakha, there are three exceptions. They say, why you are praying not with us? Why your prayer is earlier or later than the rest of the community? This is not breaking halakha. This is on account of stricter measures. They are mehadrim b'mitzvah. They are not kogim b'mitzvah. This is like the one. The second thing, which is repetitively mentioned, is the issue of shchita. Why do you think that you are better than others and you should slaughter with what's called bishlifene measures? I don't know how you translate it. You know, knife when the two, the, when the edge is where the two sides of the knife is particularly sharp. Now, they have a different way of shchita. They are shochatim le'atma. We won't go into halachot shchita into the reasoning, but they have a reason why they are shochatim le'atma. However, because of the ritual slaughtering on a different ground than the common halachic ground, there is a great deal of tension, but it's not against halacha. If anything, it mehadrim b'mitzvah. They are more makpidim and machmirim on the quality of the knife than everybody else. The only thing which is halachically debatable is the general charge that you are not mehadrim mastik b'chvot Torah v'lomdeh. You are not respecting properly the authorities of the community, the leaders of the Torah and its exponent. That means you are putting other authority or other sources of legitimacy. And this is true. Now, they don't do it against halakha, never. They have no such idea. They are coming from the same well-traditional, educated halakhic circle. However, they claim that on top of the halakhic traditional worldview, which is, of course, taken for granted, they add the mystical notion. They add study of the Kabbalah. That's the gist of the message. But there is one more thing that we have to add. The picture that I delineated, there are groups who are interested in pursuing mystical studies, are formed all along the centuries of the second half of the second millennium. This is true for all over the Jewish world. However, the level of tension between the traditional community and the new Havurot who are studying Kabbalah has different colors after the 17th century and before the 17th century. Now, in 1666, there has been a tragedy. One of the major leaders of the mystical study group set forward and claimed that he not only a great student of the Zohar, which he really was, but he is also the inaugurator of the messianic avenue promised by the Zohar here and now. This person was Shabtai Tzvi. Now we usually call him unjustly Mashiach Shekel. There is no such thing as a liar messiah. He never meant to be a liar. He never meant to be deceptive. He meant from the bottom of his heart to be a redeemer. He believed that he is adopting and he has the capacity to adopt the spiritual instruction of the Zohar and to carry a redeeming program. He was most honest man. He was not a liar. And you may ask, why did he start it? As it happened so very often in Jewish history. In 1648, there were what's known as Praot Tach V'Tach, or what's known as the pogroms, or the persecution of 1648 to 1649. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were slaughtered in the Ukraine. Please remember, Chmelnytsky, Praot Chmelnytsky, the persecutions of Chmelnytsky. 100,000 Jews were slaughtered in the Ukraine. Rivers of blood, literally, not metaphorically, rivers of blood were covering the earth. Whole community. It was such a tragedy. It was really like a holocaust in the contention and consciousness of those who were not murdered, the very few that survived. Shabbatai Tzvi was sitting covered with red silk, saying that after he read Yevem Metzulah by Nathan Hanover, after he read the report of the what was going on, written close to the time of the massacre, and after he received written reports and oral reports what was going on, he realized that the tragedy or the cup of tears is full and overflowing, and now inevitably the messianic moment must come. You should know that Chabad messianism, that you're all familiar with, started exactly on the very same ground. In 1939, where the Germans invaded Poland, the Josef Yitzchak of Lubavitch said, now that's the end of it. I know that the Jewish community would be devastated. Now is the time to start to speak on messianic evidence. I want you to realize and appreciate that there is no such thing as a lying messiah. It is the paradox of reality which lies. It's reality that lies. There is no more paradoxical thing than huge communities being slaughtered when they are utterly powerless to respond in any way. The only possible response to this complete powerlessness is the messianic response, that is, enhancing the tragedy with the meaning, promising that behind the tragedy, redemption will come. Now, of course, this is not a logical thing. This is meta-historical way of perceiving the tragic course of history. I see nothing paradoxical about messianism. I see a great deal of paradox about history. History where you are entirely denied of any power of actual response, of any power of defense, of any power of securing your life and continuity and procreation, is very soon turned into heavenly providence, or heavenly impotence, or human responsibility to elevate the powerless divinity. Remember, all this is a reworking of people who are utterly losers, desolators, people who have been beaten by history time and again. The only way to encounter that tragedy is by enhancing its meaning in a bigger scheme, in a bigger perception. Saying that all those 100,000 slaughtered Jews did not die in vain, but they died as a part of tragedy which must precede a messianic king. The ancient concept of Milchemet Gog u'Magog, the war of Gog u'Magog, or the war of those tremendous world powers, or the war of powers which are beyond our control, which would result in a great suffering and tragedy to the Jewish community, along sometimes along other communities, sometimes exclusively the Jewish community. But in order to accommodate, to enhance it with some meaning, to make a way to continue after the other tragedy, the one way is, let's understand it as a part of messianic process, built according to the metaphor of birth pains and giving birth, of birth tribulation and bringing out a baby to the world. The depth of death is the preceding of the depth of life. That's the only way to accommodate the absolute paradoxical tragedy of existence when you have nothing that you can do, when millions and thousands and singles of your own beloved family or beloved community or identity community are all being struck by history. So when you are losing historical belief and working on meta-historical things, it makes perfect sense because there is nothing else that you can do. Please realize that there is no need for messianic skin when you have power of hand or when you have divine power assured to you. Yeah.
Probably off the course of it. Probably off the subject. Messianic Zionism of the 1980s.
1980s or 1880s? No, 1980s Messianic Zionism. 1880 Messianic Zionism was a straight result of the Psufot Banegev, of the Praot in Russia. In Russia, in the 1880s, there was a great deal of persecutions of the Jews. It was called Sufot Banegev. That was the Jewish name of the pogrom of Kishinev when Bialik called Irariga. The tragic persecution of the Jewish community in Russia enlarged the breaks off the Zionistic dream, which was cultivated by Herzl and was very much cultivated by the Dreyfus trial, when it was very obvious that Jews could be charged with everything in spite of emancipation, in spite of modernization, in spite of equality. It was definitely what nourished the Zionist dream. So I don't think that Zionist messianism of the 1980s could be defined as such. That is a different story.
Well, I'm talking about 1980s and 70s.
Are you talking on Moshe Monim? That's a different kind of Zionism. That's a different kind of messianism, because it's not a messianism of despair, it's a messianism of the unexpected. It's a different kind of messianism. It comes from a different... I don't want to go into it, because it's a part of a new political reality where Jews do have power. Not when they are powerless. When all of a sudden, lo and behold, they become to be powerful. Utterly unexpected. Utterly unexpected. So the messianic reaction in the Gush Emunim circle and others is a reaction to the unexpected, while the other messianism, the whole history of Jewish messianism, is a reaction to the utmost despair of the most expected thing, of the utterly, intolerably painful destruction of your own community. No one can say it's unexpected. If in the 12th century crusade the Jewish community was desolated in the Rhineland, in the 13th century all the Jews of France were eradicated, in the 14th century in Praot, in Takna, 1391, the Jewish community was heavily persecuted in Spain. In 1499, the Jewish community was exiled from Spain. In the same period, numerous of exiles and banishments were taking place, and if anybody needs to know the details, you are highly advised to read the introductory chapter of Jonathan Israel, the Jews in the time of mercantilism. There is a very good concise history of the persecutions and the pogroms and the banishments and exiles in a very bright tone of all the facts known to us, from demography, from history, from Jewish history, from European history. The Jewish fasting in the age of mercantilism. It doesn't sound very messianic or promising, but this is a good concise introduction of Jewish history. That's like the first introductory chapter of Jewish life in the modern period. How did it all come together? So messianism is the mystical response to the atrocities of Karakos. Thus, I resent the idea of Mashiach Sheker. There is no such a thing as a liar Messiah. It's only reality which is lying. There is no such a thing as a paradoxical Messiah. It's only reality which is utterly paradoxical. So understanding what they are doing should be within the complex of utter powerlessness, utter despair as far as affecting reality, and complete power in affecting the heavenly circle so beautifully delineated in the Zohar. The Zohar tells us in 2,400 pages all what you want to know about the hidden world. The fear, their unification, their separation, the good, the evil, the Messiah, the past, the future. The Zohar is so rich and it allows so much elaboration of the hidden world that you can combine the components of the mystical Zoharic world to your own daily world of halakha and mitzvot and tzedakah in a very simple way. People understood this in them. Now, before we go to the 17th century, we must base something on the 16th century. After this revelation of Karo's Eve of Shavuot divine revelation, the students who were present, the people who were present, were deeply convinced that they were witnessing a moment of divine revelation. They had no doubt in their mind that whatever was taking place there should be labeled as a moment of divine bliss and divine truth. Now, of course, we can label it under other names. There were people who thought that they are very smart and said that it is illustration of schizophrenia or of other names of medical phenomena from the psychotic or psychological vocabulary, which are very often nothing but shallow description of things that mysticism is about transcending borders. Sometimes it's about breaking borders. And when you ask yourself, where is it in human existence that borders are constantly breaking? First and foremost, every night for each one of us, in the dream. A dream is an example of breaking borders. In our dream, we can meet at the same time in the past, the present, and the future. In our dreams, we might be honored to listen voices that, to listen to voices that otherwise we are not blessed with the opportunity to listen to them. It might be the voices of our own departed parents, God forbid, or it might be voices of our beloved, or our children, or our neighbors, or books that we read, or teachers that taught us. I mean, you never know whose voice might be introduced in the dream. We are familiar with that. We take it for granted, but it's not for granted. It's an experience of breaking borders. Now, this experience is associated also with other things of breaking borders, such as madness, such as moments of inspiration, such as the situations between when you are awake and when you are asleep, in Hebrew we call it nimlonim. Such situations, such as that Marcel Proust wrote the Search of the Lost Time in when he was in, it's not the English name of it, but it's the meaning of it, when he was in a state of consciousness that he was half asleep afterwards. A great deal of great literature has been written in a situation of semi-awake, semi-asleep consciousness. When you hear voices or you see visions and you feel that you are the channel of, you are like the tape recorder recording it, or you are the channel through which something else is speaking. Virginia Woolf, William Blake, Shmuel Yosef Avnon, Martin Luther, and many other important people in the world of literature, Charlotte Bronte and Emily Dickinson, and many, many others, which we consider as great literary treasures, are attesting on themselves in their own private diaries and sometimes in letters and communications that they perceive themselves as writers of voices that have been dictated to them from above. Sometimes they would say it's a dream, sometimes it's a voice, sometimes it's an illusion. However, it's something which is not there. It's not something that they do in their normal, controlled behavior, but something that possesses them in an unconscious, unconscientious way. Avnon has wonderful expressions of that situation, and so does Virginia Woolf, and so does Martin Luther. The common denominator to all three, which really are worlds apart, is that they wrote extraordinary writing which changed the world of many people in what they perceived to be a divine bliss from heaven or a divine voice from heaven. Now, it's very easy to judge those things and to say, look, that's a complete madness. No, it is not a complete madness. It's part of human experience, part of the wide range of the human soul, which is rather complicated and far transcending the world of the rational, far, far transcending the philosophical rational constraints or the well-behaved constraints or any other square constraint that we would put. Now, many of us can do nothing with it. Many of us cannot control it or might be controlled by it. Few of us are able to recruit those extraordinary instances and translate them into literature, science, poetry, religious revelation, charismatic methods. That thing has happened. That thing is well attested in the history of literature. If anybody is not familiar with the wonderful book by William James, The Variety of the Religious Experience, I highly recommend it. Dafka, because of the fact that it is not Jewish, it is not about Jewish problems of permitted, prohibited, but it really reflects they are overlapping and connected. And yet, in the Sages' world, those two were separated. Some were channeled into halakha, some were channeled into agadah. There is no doubt that mysticism is the daughter of the agadah. Mysticism is the continuation of the agadic freedom of exposition, of the transcending border. What is an agadah? Agadah is when Yeshua ben Levi can say, when I was flying in the air, and he would go on from this, or when I have been correcting 400 alakot about kishuim that I learned within a second. I mean, the very possibility of starting a story by saying, when I met King David, or when I and King Saul were walking together, that's an agadah. Of course, there is a different, there is a whole world there. Some is called Martian, some is called fairy tale, some is called legendary, some is called mysticism or myth. There is a whole world of literary creativity reflecting the non-rational world. This is also part of the human world. When it becomes extremely interesting, when the unreasonable creativity is really channeled into something entirely new, entirely rich, entirely inspiring, opening new spectrum of human experience or divine revelation. We should not deny it, nor should we be utterly affected by it. We should realize that these multivocal channels of human creativity are including all what is called as agadah, agadah, nevuah, myth, prophecy, mysticism, illumination, apparition, enthusiasm, devotion, all those things are part of human experience. From time to time, rarely, not often, from time to time, among the circles of people who are devoting themselves to such experiences, someone would be endowed with extraordinary such an experience that would be translated into a broader meaning. That means that, let's say, seven people are studying together a page of Zohar. Six of them would learn, the seventh one would have an inspiring moment. That can happen. If that seventh one would care to share his inspirational moment with the rest of the group, they might appreciate it, or they might say, oh, why, or it doesn't make me. From time to time, people have extraordinary inspiration, and they would be leaders of such study groups. This is the case with Moshe Cordovero, with Chaim Vital, with Yitzhak Luria, with Shabbatai Tzvi, with Nathan of Aga, with Shlomo Molcho, with Yosef Kamo. Those extraordinary students, many of them are revered students of law justice just as well. Those extraordinary authorities may also be extraordinary poetical, inspiring writers. People who could be in debate, halakhic leaders like Taro, great teachers, halakhic leaders, extremely responsible leaders of their community, could be at night inspired mystics. Taro was writing Bet Yosef during the day, while at night he was writing Magid Mei Sharim, which was his personal diary recording the voices that were heard to him, the voices that were talking to him, telling him to record down what is that he had been heard. Now it's not upon us to judge whether this is a normal phenomena, abnormal phenomena, subnormal phenomena, hypernormal phenomena. It doesn't matter at all. Matters only one thing. What are the outcomes of that phenomena? Because all of us incorporate in potential, not in actuality, in potential. We are all incorporating the capacity to play, to draw, to write, to study, to dream, but very few of us are able to take this potential and pursue it to such a degree that it would be very meaningful to others. Luria and Taro, Cordovero and Ramchal, Baal Shem Tov and Hagra, all of them had this extraordinary spiritual capacity that enabled them to explore and look into the world beyond the walls of the existential, palpable, tangible reality. the ability to see beyond it could be realized in various ways, poetical, mystical, prophetical, and so on. It could be realized in various ways. Few people are taking the trouble to take the extraordinary experience between the verge of dream, vision, apparition, moment of inspiration, divine revelation, and to communicate it to others in such a way that it would enhance the great meaning. Everybody who heard it, Hallelujah, felt that he was a part of a moment of holiness. People who heard Yosef Karo felt that they were sharing a moment of holiness. They revered the right that was given. They might very well be others that we don't know about, that criticize it. They might well be. However, those who are prone to it, or interested in it, or appreciating it, would be the majority that would continue the mystical creativity. So what's going on all along the second millennium, different mystical groups, is preparing a hothouse, if you want, to ongoing creativity in the vein of mystical thought, mystical exposition, mystical writing, mystical thinking, from time to time among those groups of people who are reading together mystical texts, taking upon themselves extra-pietistic measures. Leaders, natural leaders, are born. Those natural leaders, very often, will take the next step towards messianic expectation. Tomorrow we would finalize our reading, our discussion, and we will try to understand what can we conclude out of our month.